Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Question one, is it still the economy, stupid? Question two, what exactly does middle class mean? And question three, perhaps the most important, did the Jetsons get anything right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by Emerald Data Solutions, whose BoardDocs web applications are designed to help governing bodies operate more effectively by eliminating paper and streamlining board packet processes. BoardDocs.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, Friday, the 21st of September. Glad to have you with us. And let's get right to it. Figure out what the heck happened this week, because it's been a curious combination of the political and the economic. So Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine is with us. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. They are in our New York studios. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So we had, obviously, the 47%, the speech, the remarks by Governor Romney. Today we had his tax returns. Everybody's talking about that. 14.1% last year is the effective rate that he paid. However, Cardiff, none of that actually affects the economy. It doesn't influence the economy. Is it still the economy, stupid?
In terms of its importance to the campaign and to U.S. politics, I'd say yes, this is a distraction. But I would also say that what Romney said earlier in the week about the 47% still kind of matters, because he really mischaracterized what that group is made up of. And I think that's probably something that's going to stick for a little while. That'll be part of a larger debate about the middle class and about government and welfare state and things like that. So I think it's still the economy, and we need to give it some time, and we'll get back to it.
Interestingly, a big chunk coming up a little bit later in the broadcast on the middle class. But Lee, what do you think? I mean, is it really still the economy, or has that gotten bogged down in peripherals, as it were?
Well, right now it's bogged down in peripherals. I mean, you know, tax and tax policy is increasingly the biggest divide between the parties and the ideological debate about what kind of president you want to vote for and what you think about the future of this country. It is not what is going to, you know, it's not what's going to get us more jobs next month. It is not what's going to, you know, prevent us from falling off a fiscal cliff. It is not going to help, you know, it's not the immediacy of the urgent things that are facing the economy are not part of the conversation. But, you know, interestingly, I mean, I think historically, when the economy is weak, it does not favor the incumbent, and Obama is not suffering from that. So everything is different right now.
Yeah, but on that, and this is part of why I asked, Cardiff, right? Because if you look at the actual economy, GDP is actually growing. Housing is probably at a bottom. You know, consumer confidence is edging up. I mean, the fact is the economy is not doing terribly, right?
That's right. I mean, the one big exception to everything you just said is unemployment,
yes.
Right? So historically, if you look at it, this level of unemployment would be pretty bad. But if you look at the pace of change rather than absolute level of what's happening, that would seem to favor Obama. So actually, you almost have to just based on those things we talked about, you'd almost have to split it right down the middle. So, yeah, there's a chance that other things are what's going to actually tip or what's going to actually tip this debate. But that doesn't mean you can ignore the economy. And when we get to the debates, I think you'll see it resurface as a major issue.
Well, Lee, speaking of the debates, they're coming up, 3rd of October, I think, is the first one. I'm not positive of that date. But it's on domestic policy. Will they actually talk about the economy? Or are they gonna talk around it, as so much of the conversation has been?
I think they can't not address it, especially, you know, if you think about, you know, if Mitt Romney is going to start talking about his record as a businessman, he has to kind of address exactly what he would do to fix the economy, which he hasn't really done in anything but broad brushstrokes, the very broadest brushstrokes. So I think it'll be a number of things, but I think the economy has to be part of it.
Cardiff, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's got to come up. And I think we'll probably learn a little bit more about their sort of views on fiscal policy. We'll also, by the way, get a sense of what they think about what the Fed just did. I'm really hoping this comes up, because this is actually something that's been a little bit murky,
really?
Even though it's a big deal.
You think that they're, I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, it's going to be a wonky debate to begin with, right? You think they're going to go to the Fed?
I hope so.
I would bet against that. My odds are no Fed speak.
I don't know, right? I mean, it'd be interesting. What do you think about quantitative easing?
It's so important, though.
Yes, but come on, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it's going to necessarily be fun, but I hope we get some clarity on it.
All right. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, the major indices had it going on for a little while. Faded at the end, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For those who are a little appled out this Friday, boy, I hear you. And now that the new iPhone's out, maybe we can all start talking about another company, perhaps? But really, we can't, because with a market capitalization of $656 billion at the close today, Apple is the biggest company on the planet by stock value, which is great, but also not so great. Because you know that market rally we've had this year? Yeah, that's been Apple. Its shares are up more than 70%, but you know what? Shares can go down, too. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith takes a look at the iEconomy.
How big is Apple? Well, it accounts for about 5% of the S&P 500 stock index and more than 10% of the NASDAQ composite index. There are even predictions that iPhone sales could give a lift to the U.S. economy.
I don't think we've ever seen one company move the needle the way that Apple does now.
Alec Young is a global equity strategist for S&P Capital IQ. He says Apple's size has been great for the markets.
The fact that Apple has such a large weighting in the S&P 500 index has been good because Apple's been doing extremely well, and it's one of the reasons that the stock market has been doing very well.
The S&P 500 is up 16% this year. Apple alone is responsible for more than two of those percentage points, says Michael Farr, chief investment officer at Farr, Miller & Washington. Apple's share price has added $300 so far this year. But what Apple has given, Apple could take away.
If Apple takes a big hit, certainly markets are going to come down.
And we'd all suffer, says Georgetown finance professor James Angel.
This is what I call Apple risk. If Apple implodes, every investor is going to feel the pain.
Angel says if you own shares in a mutual fund, you probably own Apple stock. If you've got a 401k, it's probably got some shares of Apple. And if you invest in those prudent index funds, Apple's a big slice of that too, which begs the question,
is that a dangerous thing?
Angel says not yet. And as long as those new iPhones sell well, we don't have to worry about that.
So for the sake of the economy, should we all run out and get the new iPhone? Is that what you're saying?
No.
But it couldn't hurt. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I think she just wants a new iPhone, right? Here's another story of a booming brand name, Candy this time. Sometime this year, according to the market research firm Euromonitor International, Snickers is going to pass M&M's and become the number one candy brand in the world. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains exactly how that's going to happen.
Snickers flavor is anything but novel in America. The candy bar debuted in 1930. Herbert Hoover was president. But Lee Linthicum, Euromonitor's global head of food research, says the peanut chocolate combo is unusual elsewhere.
It's certainly a new flavor, a different flavor proposition from much of the rest of the world, and it's one that's actually gaining traction in many markets.
He predicts all that traction will add up to more than $3.5 billion in Snickers sales this year. The mix of salty and sweet isn't the only selling point. Linthicum says Snickers' message of a peanut-powered boost is also working.
It's almost like a de facto energy bar, like a power bar. It's not. It's a candy bar, but the peanut element is important.
That pitch has kept Snickers strong back home in America. To stay on top around the world, Snickers will need to succeed in that rather large East Asian country that winds up in nearly every global business story. Bernard Pasiniak is editor-in-chief of the trade journal Candy Industry.
China is the huge market for a lot of major chocolate and confectionery companies. You know, the Chinese don't have a history with chocolate, but they certainly have an appetite for all things Western.
He says India matters too, but chocolate is tricky because India's climate can melt it into a gooey mess. So maybe there's hope for M&M's to reclaim the top spot. After all, they promise to melt in your mouth, not in your hand. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
It's worth a mention that all the Snickers and M&M money winds up in the same place. They're both owned by Mars, which is itself amazingly family-owned, privately held. We've been hearing for the past couple of weeks on this program from some of the thousands of teachers in this country who've been laid off. Budget cuts have forced a lot of them out, but some of them leave the profession voluntarily. Eduardo de Verona came to the United States from Cuba when he was 15 years old. He eventually found his way to a job teaching social studies at Miami Beach Senior High School, but it took him a while to get there.
My grandfather was a teacher, and my mother was a teacher. I have uncles and great uncles and sisters who are also teachers. And my wife became a teacher, and she earned $7,000 a year at the time in 1975. And the two of us could not be teachers and actually survive and raise a family. So I went into business. I was an employee for 23 years and manager, and eventually owned my own pest control business. And it was pretty successful. I was able to sell it. And with the money, I paid for my master's degree and I became a teacher. I loved teaching. I loved the contact with the students. I still keep in touch with them. On my Facebook page, I have over 500 former students who are friends of mine. I retired in June of 2010 after 21 years of teaching. I got fed up. We both actually got fed up with the pressure coming from administration, from the state, from the federal level, from everywhere. We can no longer just teach. We're lucky enough to have pensions from the state and Social Security, and we both decided to retire early at 63 years old, and we're doing just fine. Now, I'm having fun. I travel, and wherever I travel, I take pictures of nature. In the first day of October, I'm going to be driving to Colorado with the specific purpose of shooting the aspens as they turn into the fall colors. I've never seen that. Hopefully, I'll get some really nice shots I'll be able to print and sell. And if I don't sell them, I'm still happy.
Amy Scott produced that piece for us. You can hear more from our series on teachers after teaching on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, so no flying cars yet, and that's not the only thing the Jetsons got wrong, you know.
Bad day at the office.
Yeah, those three-hour work days are killing me.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the Dow Industrials trimmed off a 10th percent today, 17 points, closed at 13,579. The NASDAQ added a 10th percent, an increase of 4 points, 3179. The S&P 500 came down right in the middle, right back where it started, 1460 the number. Overall, for the week, the Dow and the NASDAQ lost a 10th percent apiece. The S&P 500 ditched 0.4 percent. Shares of KB Home built an addition to the tune of 16% today, 16% after reporting a quarterly profit. Analysts had predicted a loss. You know what they say about a rising tide? Well, here you go. Home building rivals Lennar, Toll Brothers, and D.R. Horton also posted gains today. Bonds rose just a bit. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Carbonite, providing small businesses with automatic and continual cloud backup, plus anytime, anywhere access. Learn more at Carbonite.com. And by Indiana University's Kelley School of Business, providing a tailored approach to career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu. Marketplace's coverage of wealth and poverty issues is supported by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. More at fordfoundation.org. Your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. We'll get earnings from the home builder Lennar Corporation. The economic drama continues to unfold in Europe. Some speculate Spain could ask for a bailout next week. And 5 years ago today, United Auto Workers went on strike at GM plants across the country. It was the UAW's first national strike in nearly three decades. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Emmys are Sunday night, and there's the usual amount of guessing about what shows are going to win what category. But this much we already know. The major networks aren't going to win in the drama category because they don't have any shows nominated in the drama category. And furthermore, the show that does win in the drama category is going to be one that airs on Sunday night because all the nominees for Best Drama do. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains what's up.
So how did cable and PBS snatch up all the Emmy drama nominations?
The short answer is because they're better.
Ouch. Amanda Lotz is a professor at the University of Michigan.
And so the real question is, why are they better?
Part of it, she says, is that the networks play it safe. They want to show that me and my mom and my teenage neighbor are all going to watch. Cable isn't trying to win that contest. Take AMC's Breaking Bad, one of this year's Emmy nominees, about a teacher turned meth king.
There's no denying the popularity of our product. There's a market to be filled.
Okay, not to start a fight with Walter White, but there is some denying that popularity. The season finale of Breaking Bad had about 1/6 the viewers of Sunday Night Football.
There are probably a lot of people who willingly turn away from that show. They find the violence offensive or the concept disturbing. And, you know, it's not trying to be a show for those people. If that's not what you want, then it's okay for you not to watch it.
You'll certainly have a lot of other choices. From Mad Men to Downton Abbey, all of the nominated dramas are Sunday night shows. Brian Lowry is a TV critic for Variety.
Sunday is traditionally the night with the highest TV viewing levels.
But he says that time slot matters less and less with DVRs.
HBO and Showtime have data that shows that even with their most popular shows, about a third of the total viewing is done on Sunday night.
Football doesn't keep quite as well. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
A story now from our wealth and poverty desk.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
It's actually not a story about wealth or poverty, really. It's kind of in between somewhere. It's a story about a group that both presidential candidates have spent a lot of time talking about.
Middle class families.
The middle class of America.
The middle class.
The middle class.
But who exactly is the middle class? There is no government definition. Economists don't always agree. Most people think they're in there somewhere. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark explores who we're really talking about when we talk about the middle class.
When you close your eyes and picture the typical middle class American, what do you see?
You got a job.
Work.
A decent wage.
And maybe this.
You own a house.
Home.
A barbecue in the backyard. From LA to Cleveland to Dallas, no matter where we asked people to define middle class, they agreed on a lot of the basics. But start filling in the details and things get tricky. Like that decent job. What qualifies as decent?
White collar.
Doctor. Lawyer.
As well as blue collar.
Teachers.
Skilled trades.
Auto worker.
In fact, people couldn't agree on even just the basic philosophy of what it means to be middle class. Is it
the ability to provide the necessities of life?
Or this.
Able to buy things not because they need to, but because they want to.
Okay, so if you're confused, that's because the definition of middle class is confusing. Especially at this point in history.
It's like middle class is disappearing.
It ain't but rich and poor right now.
It's not what it used to be, basically.
So, what did it used to be? It must be time for
great moments in middle class history.
First stop, 1792. One of the first references to the middle class is made by an American, namely Thomas Paine, who wrote,
"A poll tax was levied. It excited, as it naturally must, universal detestation among the poor and middle classes."
Even then, the middle class stereotype was someone annoyed by taxes. But aside from that, the similarities end, because the middle class Paine was talking about wasn't white collar or blue collar. It was
the yeoman farmer.
That's Michael Lind with a think tank called the New America Foundation. Once upon a time, he says, our founding fathers realized that if they were going to actually make their crazy idea of a democracy work, they needed something that didn't really exist yet.
A dominant middle class who, because of a certain amount of economic security and economic independence, is capable of playing various roles that society in a republic demands, whether it's as a voter or as a juror.
And since there were a lot of farmers running around back then, they seemed like good candidates for the job. But Lind argues these guys didn't just naturally become economically independent and secure. Americans' first middle class didn't just happen. It was made.
An artificial creation of private sector and public sector policies. Distribution of federal land to farmers through the Homestead Act. Elementary public education.
Of course, by the early 1900s, new technology meant we needed fewer farmers. The rest headed to factories and cities where they didn't get paid much. America looked at its dissolving middle class and started freaking out.
Thinkers on the left and the right and the center in the United States argued that, well, we have to do something. A desperate, low-wage majority that lacked property, that lacked any stake in society, would turn to demagogues. And a stable democracy requires a dominant middle class.
The average man must have that opportunity.
It took almost 30 years for the country to figure out how to bring that new factory worker majority into the middle class, something Franklin Roosevelt was still grappling with when he was president.
In the opportunity to accumulate a margin of security against the inevitable vicissitudes of life.
Those opportunities were secured, Lind says, thanks to public and private policies created during the New Deal and after World War II. Social Security, labor laws, the GI Bill. And voila, a new version of the middle class was born. Of course, fast forward to today, and we need fewer factory workers in the U.S., thanks once again to technology and a changing global economy. It's a very similar moment to the one 100 years ago, when we were shifting off the farms, according to Michael Lind. We've got a void where the bulk of the middle class used to be, and we haven't quite figured out how to fill it.
Education was the gateway to opportunity for me.
And both presidential candidates are trying to come up with a new vision for the future of the middle class this election year. For Obama, education is key.
It is the gateway to a middle class life.
For Romney, it's small business.
America's engine of job growth. That means reducing taxes on business, not raising them.
The problem is the math simply does not work.
That's Michael Lind again, and he means the math on both sides. On one hand, only about 10% of Americans are self-employed. On the other hand, 70% don't have college degrees. So the bulk of Americans won't be owning small businesses or becoming white-collar professionals anytime soon. Most of the jobs will be
personal service jobs, everything from elder care to child care
to janitors and restaurant servers, jobs that can't be offshored or automated.
The question is, will this be a huge population of the working poor, or will we undertake the social reforms necessary to turn a service sector majority into a middle class majority?
Lind says if we're really worried about the future of the middle class in this election, that's what we should be talking about. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Send us your pictures of what the middle class looks like to you. You can do that and see what other listeners sent at marketplace.org. A pause now to note a milestone. 50 years ago this Sunday, the first episode of The Jetsons went on the air. The life and times of the average American family circa 2062, which means if you stop to think about it, we're halfway to the future. Andrew Parsons reports.
Meet George Jetson. Life for the Jetsons is pretty sweet, but this futuristic family never seems to notice. George still complains about appliances acting up.
Well, his coffee tastes like rocket fuel.
And traffic in his flying car.
Boy, the spaceway traffic gets worse every night.
And then there's work.
Bad day at the office.
Yeah, those 3-hour work days are killing me.
In the 1960s, economists assumed that the trend of shrinking workdays would continue as it had since the late 1800s. Seminal British economist John Maynard Keynes predicted that a 3-hour workday was 100 years off as early as 1930. Gary Burtless is an economist at the Brookings Institution.
When Keynes thought that people might only be working 3 hours a day, he had in mind sort of a straight line of trends that rich societies had seen for the previous 70 or 80 years.
So what's changed? Well, a lot of things fundamentally. We're still getting more productive, just not as fast as before. And the gains that had been going to productivity now go elsewhere. For example, Burtless says, to the income gap.
If the people at the top are getting more, there's a smaller percentage left over for workers in the middle and at the bottom.
When it comes to the future, there will still be economic growth and innovation. but just not as much, according to Northwestern University economics professor Robert Gordon.
Things are just going to slow down. I'm predicting that the standard of living will double in the next 50 or 60 years. But it used to be that the standard of living would double in 30 years.
So even if we can imagine Rosie the robot helping out around the house in the future, the prospects of a three-hour workday don't seem as, well, rosy.
You got a light?
Allow me, sir.
I'm Andrew Parsons for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive, offering policyholders the option to bundle home and auto insurance coverage. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And by the Nuclear Energy Institute, dedicated to promoting the safe use of nuclear energy to create economic growth and thousands of jobs. NEI.org. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
We're going to end today right where we started, the news of the week gone by, but with a twist, the stuff that didn't quite make the headlines. And we're going to do it the same way we always do, by sending Marketplace alumni Rico Galliano and Brendan Francis Noonan out to ask around.
Chris Berube, intern, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, there are the scientists in Scotland who did a study of email habits, and they came up with a bird for each type of habit that people have. So, for example, a person could be a compulsive woodpecker. That means that they're checking their email every day and every night all the time.
Okay, so what are you?
I'm worried that I might be a pesky crow. That's a type of person who really leans on people by sending the same email over and over again with slightly different wording.
Oh, that's all right. I'm a pterodactyl.
What do you mean you're a pterodactyl?
We like handwritten letters and we no longer exist.
Celeste Wesson, senior editor. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
A young man in Oregon who stole an antique coin collection. And he was discovered because he and his girlfriend spent some of the antique coins at face value for pizza and a movie.
How much were these coins worth?
There was a quarter, which he spent, you know, to pay his pizza bill, worth up to $18,000.
Oh, my God. But it had, you know, sun-dried tomatoes on the pizza.
Of course.
That's a gourmet topping. That's expensive.
Heidi Moore, New York Bureau Chief. What's your story?
I'm fascinated by this story that New Jersey has actually made it illegal for you to smile in your driver's license photo.
Oh, so we're all in compliance already.
Exactly.
So why can't you smile?
Well, New Jersey has this facial recognition software to prevent fraud, and if you smile, it distorts your face.
That sounds bizarre, but I can understand why software programmers wouldn't anticipate anyone smiling at a DMV.
The radio show that Brendan and Rico do is called The Dinner Party. There's a link to it on our homepage. Okay, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow dropped 17 points, 0.1%, 13,579 at the close. The NASDAQ added 4 points, 0.1%, 3,179 at the bell. The S&P 500, well, that was flat. 1460 is where it ended things. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, your questions answered, like how much to borrow for college.
If you're a liberal arts major, you probably don't want to borrow much more than 35 grand. If you're more of a math science person, you could probably borrow up to twice that.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.